Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Dissidents and Dictators. I'm Alicia Maldonado. Here with me, of course, is my bird-watching co-host, Casey Michelle. Say hi.
Hello.
We've got another full episode for you today. We'll be chatting with Joey Su, a 25-year-old activist who played a vital role in Hong Kong's 2019 pro-democracy protests. After fleeing Hong Kong in 2020, she served as an advisor to the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China and as a policy advisor to Hong Kong Watch. She's a Freedom Fellow at the Human Rights Foundation, the Asia-Pacific Coordinator for the World Liberty Congress, an advisor to the Athenaeum Institute, and manages the Hong Kong program at the National Democratic Institute. If that's not enough, she also has the distinction of being one of the first 13 Hong Kongers in exile with a bounty on their heads for violating the national security law. We'll be talking about that and a lot more, so stay tuned. Joey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
How do you make the time with that busy schedule and the mischief of going up against China every day?
Well, it's been very, very hard. You know, I'm just one person. I've only got 24 hours a day. And then with the Chinese Communist Party that we are fighting against with so much power, resources, and money, it has been really an uphill battle every single day. However, I think I'm really privileged enough to have so many great allies from the community, Hong Kongers in exile, and then most importantly, other really amazing allies from the Tibetan, Uyghur, and other communities also impacted by the CCP. I think it is the collective, you know, allyship that is bringing us together and allowing us to really contribute to the fight.
Joey, reading through your bio as Alicia just did so flawlessly right there. It's, you know, when I first saw this, I just assumed you were mid-career, late career. I don't know. And then I saw you're only 25 years old, and you already have this incredible resume, to say nothing of the bounty, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. I know this began, what was it, back in 2019 during the protests that we saw. I was wondering, Joey, if you could actually just take us back a little bit to that period. I mean, this is something we like to ask some of our guests sometimes. I mean, is this something from, you know, you as a child, you had someone you looked up to that you said, this is going to be my path, I'm going to model my pro-democracy activities on them? Or was this something that, I don't know, were you in university, you were in school? When did this really begin for you? What point do you look back to and say, that's when things started, and all of a sudden here you are on this path that's followed for years after?
The catalyst that sort of inflamed action.
Yeah, I think after I came to Washington, D.C., after, you know, leaving Hong Kong, whenever people got to know that I was only 20-something years old, they will all be very, very surprised and shocked, and obviously feel bad for me for having to, you know, go into exile at such a young age. But I think my passion for social issues was really, you know, shaped at a very, very young age. I grew up in a very, you know, strict Asian household. I grew up with my grandmother, who is like a, you know, what we call a tiger parent. She did not, you know, support me, you know, reading novels, short stories, watching, you know, dramas on television or any sort of things like that. But the one thing that she did allow me to do was to read very extensively newspaper and then to watch news broadcasts every night, every evening in Hong Kong. And without much of a choice, that was the only thing that I had access to. And I think that was really how I naturally got to, you know, learn so much more about Hong Kong, about China, and about things that is happening around the world. And that just got me so interested in understanding not just what is going on, what is happening, but more so on what can I do to help make things better. So I think that was how I, you know, initially got interested in social issues. But really, the starting point of my activism, I would say, was when the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong broke out in 2014. Mm-hmm. At that time, you know, the revolution was led by a group of very young activists, including people like Joshua Wong, who is only almost 20 years old. And at that time, I was in high school. That was the first time ever when I started organizing something on my own. I organized, you know, class boycott campaigns. I rallied my classmates and schoolmates to do a joint statement, a joint letter. I encourage people to, you know, join me into going into the protest scenes and to show support to other people who have been occupying the central business district in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. That was how I first got into activism. And moving forward to 2019, at the time I was studying, I was a political science major student at the City University of Hong Kong. And when you know, the government told us that they're proposing this extradition agreement with mainland China, which essentially erodes and brings down all of these core values of Hong Kong, it just came very naturally that I decided I had to do something. And at that time, I was serving on the student union, and just very naturally, I became a more public-facing activist, organizing larger rallies in Hong Kong.
So we have, it was your grandma to thank for exposing you to the news, to watching, to reading, and again, following day in, day out, year in, year out, not just any news, but obviously the slow decline of the kind of democratic freedoms Hong Kong had enjoyed for for years. I did want to ask, Joey, you know, we've been talking about age, your age as well, and you just mentioned Joshua Wong a moment ago. You know, I certainly don't confess to be any expert in Hong Kong politics whatsoever, which is obviously why we want to have you on today, but it strikes me, or at least it seems, that in Hong Kong especially, not just in the region, but even globally, the protest movement, the pro-democracy energy for the last 10 years does seem like it's had this extremely and especially youthful bent, whether in 2014, whether through the late 2010s, and obviously continuing with you today. I mean, is that your impression? Is there an especially kind of demographic focus or centering of that energy on younger Hong Kongers? Or is maybe that just kind of the impression from some media coverage?
No, I think that's a very accurate observation, Casey. I think, you know, looking back at the 2019 pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong, the umbrella revolution in 2014, you can see that it's always the young people that are leading these protests, that are being the major group of people that are, you know, supporting and organizing and then, you know, rallying the grassroots and rallying different people from different sectors within the society. And I think that has a lot to do with Hong Kong being such a small city. Hong Kong is only of 7 million people, and just very naturally, you know, university students, college students, they had so many opportunities to be able to engage in that, you know, discussion about Hong Kong's future, to engage in political activities inside of Hong Kong. You always see, you know, alliances of college and university students making up such an important political contribution, a very, very important stakeholder in political discourse inside of Hong Kong. You see so many young people every year running for legislative council elections in Hong Kong when that was still allowed. And beyond those who are running, you also see, you know, so many young people becoming the main driving force behind so many successful election campaigns. So I think it's very true that back in the days when Hong Kong was still enjoying that certain degree of freedom and democracy, young people did have a lot of chance to engage in these activities and to take up these opportunities to become the leading political voices in Hong Kong. And even looking at the situation right now, even with the national security law, the new Article 23, you still see this major group of young people still trying to persist and resist inside of Hong Kong, whether it be supporting political prisoners who are still inside of prison going through trials, whether it be it, you know, supporting the pro-democracy economic circle in Hong Kong or organizing, focusing on other human rights issues in Hong Kong. I think you are absolutely right that young people has been playing a very, very important role. And even in exile right now, you see young Hong Kongers like myself coordinating with young Tibetans, Uyghurs, organizing campaigns like the No Beijing 2022 campaign that happened 2 years ago, where we successfully got so many democracies to commit to a diplomatic boycott, etc. I think it's absolutely right that we are seeing young people being that driving force. And I think that also reminds us of the importance of continuing to support younger generations to, you know, flourish, to learn, to grow, and then to become that generation where we can pass on this spirit to and to be able to, you know, sustain that fight for us.
Joey, I wanted to ask you about, because I'd like to kind of have you talk more on it, but can you kind of talk about, we'll start with what, you know, prompted you to leave in 2020, kind of what was the impetus for that, and now being one of a number of people in exile who the CCP are still trying to to extend that long arm of transnational oppression. Can you talk about why you left and then the work that you do here, and then get to the bounty, you know, the punishment from abroad?
Yeah, sure. So back in 2019, I became a more public-facing student leader organizing a lot of these pretty large-scale protests and demonstrations and rallies, all that sort of, you know, disobedience activities inside of Hong Kong. And ever since then, I have been exposed, and all of my personal information, my ID number, my email address, my home address, my my school, obviously, my major, mm-hmm. all that sort of information, and even for my parents, my brothers, and my grandmother's information, all of those personal information and details about my family have been, you know, exposed and circulated online by these pro-Beijing actors. So at that point, starting from that point, I already feel very unsafe, not for myself. I understand very clearly that by becoming this activist, I signed up for these harassment and death threats, but that is not something that my family members signed up for. Mm-hmm. My brother, who was doing school, he did not sign up for that. My grandmother, who is 70-something years old, she did not sign up for that. So starting from that point, I already felt, you know, unsafe for my family members. However, after those online harassments and threats, those kind of harassment later on translated into, you know, physical harassment and threats, to a point where every single day I would be followed by suspicious people who I assumed to be plainclothes police officers, right. And also later on, after the implementation of the national security law, people whom I suspect to be national security agents, every single day they would be following me to underground stations, metro stations. Whenever I go to a meeting, they would be following me to that single building. Every night when I go home, they would be following me again. And that kind of following and harassment really intensified to a point where it gotten so bad after the national security law. And through those years, I know that what I have been doing, you know, organizing grassroots efforts, and then more so beyond that, also the fact that I'm organizing international advocacy for Hong Kong, calling for, you know, sanctions against Hong Kong officials and Chinese officials. I know that that is something that has clearly overstepped the Chinese Communist Party, the Hong Kong authorities' mm-hmm. red line. And I understand very clearly that if I don't leave after the national security law, I would be put into jail and I would be sentenced to 10 years or even a lifetime in prison. And because of my connections with, you know, politicians overseas, it was, I think, August 2020 that I had received a message and a warning from connections that I had in Washington, D.C., telling me that we think this is the last chance for you to leave or else you will be put into prison. So, you know, upon receiving that warning, I started thinking very seriously whether or not I should leave Hong Kong. The first time, it was August, I bought my first ticket to leave Hong Kong, but I did not board that flight because I was still thinking that maybe there is still a chance for me to, you know, advocate from on the ground. Mm-hmm. All the people that I love are in Hong Kong. How could I leave them? So the first time I bought a ticket, I did not board that plane. I did not leave. However, again, I have, you know, I kept receiving warnings from those people that I talked to, other people. At the same time, I continue, you know, engaging with international actors. I continue, you know, speaking at panels organized by the European Parliament, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was towards the end of September that I received a final warning that this is really, really your last chance. Don't make us, you know, mm-hmm. tell you to leave again. So the second time I bought another ticket, and this time I finally boarded that plane that left Hong Kong. And yeah, that was my story of, you know, having to go into exile.
And Joey, how long after that did you learn that there was this bounty, again, that you were one of the very first Hong Kongers in exile to have this bounty placed upon you? As Alicia mentioned, obviously a clear sign of transnational repression. Was that soon after? Did you have to wait some time?
Yeah, it was actually almost 2 years after I have left Hong Kong. It was actually 3 years after I have left Hong Kong. I left late 2020, and then the bounty came on December 13, 2023, which is a few months ago. During those 3 years, I have always known that the authorities is watching me. Every time I testify before the Congress on, you know, humanitarian pathways for Hong Kong or sanctions against Hong Kong and Chinese officials, immediately the next day you will see an article trying to defame me, trying to you know, attack me on Wenhuibao and Dagongbao, which are state-run media in Hong Kong, and you will see these articles accusing me of being, you know, the usual is the CIA agent or being paid by the US government. You will see all these, you know, articles circulated on WeChat, on these, you know, Chinese state-run social media platforms, etc. So I have always known that they are watching me. They are, they want to take revenge to what I have been doing, what I have been advocating for Hong Kong overseas. But it wasn't until December 13th that a bounty actually came with you know, this international arrest warrant and then the $1 million Hong Kong dollar bounty.
Did you know that the bounty was coming? Did you have a heads up? And then I guess I'm just wondering what that was like when you yeah. learned that all of a sudden there's this, what is this, $1 million?
Yeah,
On your, I mean, what was that like learning about that?
And what was going through? Yeah, what was going through your brain?
Yeah, so, you know, as you may remember, the first batch of the bounty came in July 2023. That time they were asking to arrest six Hong Kong activists who are overseas. And immediately after that first batch came out, I was, you know, warned by connections that I still had on the ground that my name will be appearing in the second batch. So it was since July that I have known that my name will likely be in the second batch. You know, as I said, I have always known that the Hong Kong authorities is, you know, watching me, tracking my activities very, very closely. So I have always been trying to prepare myself mentally for that bounty or for whatever form that revenge is in. Ever since I left Hong Kong, I try my very best to prepare myself for that, which includes, you know, of course, preparing myself mentally for that. And also, you know, I have stopped talking to my family ever since I left Hong Kong, which is 3.5 years ago, for the fact that I know if one day I am to be persecuted or to become this wanted fugitive under the Hong Kong authorities' national security law, I know for a fact that my family members will be put at a very, very great risk of being, you know, interrogated, mm-hmm. arrested, or even put into prison for their ties with me. So I have been preparing myself for 3 years, and specifically after people gave me warning in July 2023. But honestly, still, when the bounty came the morning of December 13th, I immediately realized that no mental preparation would ever mm-hmm, be right. enough. You know, I woke up to the news from Reuters, I believe, where they have this headline saying that five more overseas activists now wanted by the Hong Kong authorities, including one American citizen. Immediately, I saw my picture, my Hong Kong ID photo taken when I was 18 years old in Hong Kong, the very, very young, inexperienced me. I saw the picture and I immediately knew what happened. Mm-hmm. I have a bounty on me right now. I have this arrest warrant on me right now. I thought I would be prepared. I thought I would be calm, but the reality is I wasn't calm. I was nervous and I was panicking. I was anxious. I did not know what to do, not for myself, because I know that here in the US, I am safe. There's no way they can come get me. But I am extremely, extremely worried about my family and friends who are still inside of Hong Kong. The immediate thought that I had was, where are they? Are they okay? Are they going to be brought into interrogation? You know, I immediately thought of my grandma, my brother. I immediately thought if they would be taken into interrogation for things that I have been doing overseas, which they have absolutely no knowledge of. So it's just that now, thinking back, I can still remember, you know, that morning I woke up to the news, was panicking, the first thing that I did was, you know, wanting to check on them, but I haven't been talking to them in 3 years, and I know that talking to them right now wouldn't be safe. So yeah, it was a mixture of a lot of emotions.
It's interesting too, you know, that as you noted, you're an American citizen as well. So the CCP isn't just coming after a Hong Kong or an exile, but also an American citizen.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, in the past do don't realize how is the national security law or anything that the Chinese government or the Hong Kong government has been doing, you know, violating human rights, cracking down on democracy is relevant to them. However, I think after my bounty came out, that served as a awakening call for some people that I know of, you know, seeing that me being an American citizen, advocating here in the U.S., you know, encouraging my representatives to stand up for freedom, democracy, and human rights, and all these things that I have been doing in the U.S. as a citizen have got me to becoming a wanted person under the national security law. I think that really served as an awakening call for a lot of Americans and citizens of democracies, and really helped them realize that the Chinese authorities and then the Hong Kong government's long arms are really beyond boundaries, beyond, you know, borders, and that impacts so seriously every single one of us in every corner of this world.
Well, so let's bring things back to Hong Kong for a moment. I think, again, a lot of folks have been broadly, tangentially aware of the CCP's crackdown in Hong Kong for years at this point, you know, the national security law back in 2020, so on. But again, Hong Kong has been in the news over the past few weeks, I guess the past month or so now, because of what's known as Article 23. Can you give us a quick rundown of what Article 23 is, how it builds upon what the CCP had been doing previously, and the kind of implications for both Hong Kong, as well as yourself and others that are working in this space now that Article 23 is on the books?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Hong Kong authorities have been cracking down on underground protests and then threatening activists who are advocating from overseas with the national security law. But this new legislation to Article 23, it further prohibits a lot of very broadly defined disobedience, including, you know, under the names of treason, sedition, thief of state secrets, and espionage, or even, you know, collaborating with what they consider as a foreign political organization from conducting political activities inside of Hong Kong, or simply establishing ties with foreign political organizations. All of these could be seen as a violation of Article 23. You know, today, if someone from Hong Kong is, you know, speaking or engaging with the Human Rights Foundation, for example, in any capacity, that could be seen as a violation under of the Article 23 as well. And with the Article 23, one thing that we definitely foresee is that they will definitely use this to further escalate the transnational repression that they have been doing against our community over the past few years. They want to silence our activism overseas. They want to stop us from talking, engaging with politicians overseas, from encouraging sanctions against the Hong Kong and Chinese officials, from building alliances with other communities oppressed by the CCP or other communities oppressed by regimes that are friendly to the CCP. All of these things we will see them doing. And furthermore, we will also see them, you know, exploiting the Article 23 to potentially have democracies, to pressure democracies into extraditing activists that they're targeting back to Hong Kong. That is also a possibility as well. And another thing that I wanted to highlight also is that both the national security law and Article 23 that we're talking about, both of them have extraterritorial jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have been saying, that's why we have been emphasizing really that the national security law and Article 23, it's not just legislations that will impact Hong Kongers or mm-hmm. Chinese people or those that are inside of China or Hong Kong, that impacts every single one of us here in the U.S., in the UK or other countries as well.
Yeah, what the CCP is doing in Hong Kong and to Hong Kongers is by no means limited to Hong Kong right. or even just the Hong Kongers themselves. I mean, this, you know, Alicia, you and I were at a dinner not long ago talking about Jimmy Lai, obviously mm-hmm. the jailed democracy activist. And, you know, some of the things that we were talking about at the dinner, to my mind that stuck out on my end is that I think a lot of folks right now are certainly paying attention to the news in places like Ukraine and what that may potentially mean for places like Taiwan and then the kind of broader conversations about democracy itself. But I think a lot of folks have forgotten, certainly didn't pay enough attention to at the time, and maybe still aren't even paying enough attention to, the example that Hong Kong set mm-hmm. even before what we saw in Ukraine and certainly before what may take place in Taiwan. And Joey, this gets back to your work, why your work is so important, highlighting what the CCP has done and obviously continues to do in Hong Kong to Hong Kongers and obviously to activists like yourself. I did want to ask, while we have a little bit of time left for you, Joey, what you're working on these days. Again, I'm sure you don't sleep at all based on your resume alone. But what kind of projects are you working on that you can share with us today?
Yeah, so there are mainly two areas of work that I have been focusing on. So first of all, obviously advocating for Hong Kong, building our very, very new, very young diaspora community all across the U.S. and across the world. One thing that we have been really advocating for is for Hong Kong to stay under the international spotlight, you know, with so many affairs happening all across the world, in Ukraine, in the Middle East, and elsewhere in Taiwan, for example. It is really easy for, you know, stakeholders, for international lawmakers to overlook the importance of taking Hong Kong seriously, because Hong Kong really is a lesson that the world should be learning from Hong Kong. You see how the CCP is capable of turning an international financial center into this place where there's only among 7 million people, you have almost 2,000 political prisoners. I think that is one thing that we really wanted to the world to be able to see and then learn from. And then secondly, another main area of my work is really much focused on building alliances and coalitions. I think in the past, we have built alliances with the Uyghur Tibetan communities, which led to successful campaigns. And now we're hoping to extend our coalition to, you know, include also Venezuelans, Iranians, mm-hmm. Belarusians, Cambodians, all of these communities. You can see from their stories how the CCP is also playing a role in leading to the crackdown and oppression of their people inside of their countries. You know, you see Xi Jinping over the past few years shaking hands with Putin as he invades Ukraine. Yeah. You see him, you know, touring, parading around Iran and Venezuela while the Venezuelan and Iranian people are suffering from simply wanting their basic rights as an human being. So I think a lot of the times our destinies, our fates are really very much intertwined and interconnected. And collectively, we know that we're always a more impactful voice. So a lot of my time have been dedicating to creating these alliances through, you know, the World Liberty Alliance, where we have activists and human rights defenders from so many countries. We're hoping that we can consolidate that effort and become this one collective impactful voice for democracy against dictators.
Well, I think that's pretty awesome. And then I think it's very inspiring that you just refuse to bend the knee. I just find that so admirable, despite all the things that you could, you know, the risks that you face and that your family faces, that you refuse to let them win, and you continue to advocate for those, you know, people that you just mentioned. I just think it's really admirable.
Joey, how can listeners follow more of your work? Do you have a website? Do you have a social media account they can follow?
Yeah, you can find me on X, or known as Twitter. You can also find me on Instagram. And I really encourage all of our listeners to also follow, you know, HRF, WLC. Both organizations have been great allies in supporting our cross-movement coalition building and have been such an important voice and platform for us to amplify our message. So please do follow us, take actions to support our work.
Well, we always say that our favorite guests are the ones that bring their followers into HRF as well, especially on social media. So thank you, Joey. Thank you for everything that you have done. Obviously, thank you for joining us today. And I can't wait to see what is next for you.
Thank you again for having me.
Thanks, Joey. See you soon. The Human Rights Foundation is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes and protects human rights globally, with a focus on closed societies. We promote freedom where it's most at risk, in countries ruled by authoritarian regimes.